Deep in the imagination, there's a crossroads, a space where curiosity and inspiration intersect and give birth to ideas. A space where music, science fiction, comic books, and pop culture inform the mind of what is and what could be. This is Jeff Boucher's Mind Space. In each episode, legendary journalist Jeff Boucher welcomes the biggest names in genre entertainment for an expansive dive into all things pop culture. Journey with Jeff as he explores the latest news and recommendations of the hottest releases across entertainment with his most trusted confidants. You are now entering deep space. Heavy Metal presents Jeff Boucher's Mind Space.
Hi, welcome to Mindspace. This is Jeff Boucher, and I'm here with Maya St. Clair. And this week, we are talking to Alberto Mielgo, who is an Emmy-winning animator, and he is director of The Windshield Wiper, which is a short film that a lot of people, including us, are expecting to be part of the Academy Awards field coming up soon. So we're very, very excited to have him on the show.
Yeah, heavy metal fans, you might know him from his short film, The Witness, which is one of the episodes in the Netflix show, Love, Death, and Robots. That won a bunch of Emmys. It's extremely dark and sexual, as is The Windshield Wiper.
Yeah, it is dark. And he worked on Spider-Verse, right? Also,
yeah, on the other end, you know. Yeah. He was also very influential in the creation of Sony's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. He's got a really distinct animation style that's immediately recognizable. He's also done kind of animated and production design for video games, including Watch Dogs, because he's got a kind of graffiti style that fits with their kind of urban uprising there. And then he also did the production design and the animated intro for the Beatles Rock Band,
which is pretty great.
An extremely beloved little animated snippet you should definitely check out, but it's iconic. I don't think scientists have really found a formula for human happiness, but it somewhat resembles having a bunch of penguins sing I Am the Walrus. So
it's pretty great. And Beatles Rock Band was huge in my household. You know, my kids really love that, and it was such a great way to share music that I was very passionate about, and watching them become passionate about it and actually know the music better than me by the end was really, really pretty cool. I'll always be thankful for that moment in time, you know?
Yeah, but you and Alberto had a great conversation about, you know, all sorts of stuff, artistic honesty and integrity and creativity. So it's extremely interesting. We're wishing him the absolute best at the Oscars, and we Absolutely. Encourage you to check out The Windshield Wiper. It's on YouTube for a limited time as the animated short of the week. So definitely check that out. We'll get right to it. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Alberto, welcome to the show. It's very nice to talk to you today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
And you are talking from where today exactly?
Today I am in my country, in Madrid, and today I happen to be in the room that I grow up.
Oh wow!
Because yeah, it's weird. I'm visiting my family, and I'm in the same bed where I was sleeping when I was like sit down in the bed when I was like fucking, you know, like 2 to 16 or 17 that I left.
Wow. And so and has it been hermetically sealed, all your stuff still intact, or has it been redesigned?
No, of course, redesigned. It's been repurposed, you know, it's been like a storage place.
Your yesterday's news.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like and I contribute to that. Like every time that I come, I'm like, okay, let's tie it up because there is so much shit here.
So let's see now. So when you were say 15, 16, you would have been, what would have been on your walls? What would I have seen on your walls that would help me know what kind of things you were interested in?
Interesting. Basically comic books that I was doing. I was not kind of like, I mean, maybe earlier I have posters, you know, of I don't know, like a football team that I like, maybe Michael Jackson, but that was earlier, I suppose. When I was like 15, 16, kind of like I decorating my own thing with either paintings of mine or my own comic books.
That's exciting. That's good. Yeah. I would have had some of my art on the walls, but my art wasn't good enough, so I had a lot of other people's art. But cool. I wanted to be an artist. When I was in high school, I actually was taking classes with a hope of being an artist, and I still draw and paint. But actually, my art teacher sat me down, gave me a talk when I was a junior, and said, you know what? When I was your age, I was better than you, and I'm doing this, and this is okay, but this isn't that great. And
oh my God.
And I was like, I was really upset. But what she said is she had the school newspaper, and I had written an article for the school newspaper, and I'd interviewed a student who had been hit by a drunk driver and been paralyzed, and wow. Wrote this story. And she said, you know, I read the story. Everybody's read the story. Everybody's crying. And this is special that you can do this. You should do that.
Interesting.
And I was like, it was really threw me off. Like I was flattered, but also like kind of hurt. And it was just a real strange bundle of feelings. But later many years later, that was in 1986, 1997, I had a book published and I sent it to a teacher. I sent her a copy. Said, you were right.
Nice. That's so cool. Yeah. You see, I think that, if you, like, for example, I have a similar scenario, but I actually was the opposite in terms of the teacher. Really? Like, I remember my mother was asking for advice because I was always drawing and kind of like in the school, I was basically drawing, painting nonstop. And my mother asked to a teacher, like, shall I put him in a school or shall he go and learn? And the teacher actually says, like, no, don't do it, like, let him just be free and enjoy, don't put him rules. And I think that that's very interesting, because in my career I realized that I never train on purpose, like I always practice by accident, because I always had projects, like my own comic books since I am very young, or you know, film projects or things that I wanted to do before becoming a professional. I always had something, some stories to tell or some stories to draw, or maybe a project of paintings. So I never found myself, okay, today I'm gonna draw faces, or today I'm gonna draw hands, you know, or today I'm gonna train, which I think training sucks, right? I think it's right. like you lose the
joy.
Like, for example, I remember, when I was at Disney, it was a triathlon team, and they contacted me because I was cycling to the studio every day, right? And then they said, let's do a race. And the race was some sort of like a Malibu triathlon thing that they do in the summer, in September. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. And I always run and I always cycle, but because I like it. And I ended up doing third in my category, which was pretty incredible. And then that very much supports the whole thing. It's like, okay, I never trained, but I was just doing it for fun. And then all of a sudden I was good at it. Few months later, I start training and I'm disliking it, you know? Uh-huh. I'm like, I don't like cycling for the sake of training. You know, like training was kind of like hard. You know, you have to wake up at this time. You have to measure the time. You have to run faster. You need to do like a series of sprints. And then I realized, oh my God, this is so boring. I hate it. And I love cycling and running. So I stopped doing it and I stopped training. And now I keep doing it just for the sake of, you know, like commuting or running because I like, but never training.
Was there another association, or was it just the routine of it, or is it the hours, or it just sapped the joy out of it for you?
Yeah, it's just studying, you know, like it's just like the, instead of like doing something because you are enjoying it and you like it, it's the same as when I was doing my paintings and my projects, you know, probably if I go to a school, they will start teaching me, you know, No, you don't hold the pencil like that. No, you need to mix the colors like this. No, you don't look at the object like that. And they start imposing exercises that they are not your choices. And I think that that's what that completely drew me off in this kind of, in the sport case. And then I basically support the idea just by telling you this kind of like short triathlon time in my life.
Yeah.
Very short.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, but the thing is that you were so fully formed as an artist that you were creating your own craft. I mean, if you said you didn't do practice, you didn't draw faces one day because you were publishing your own comic book. Well, that means you're drawing faces and everything in the comic book. I mean, that's you're exactly inventing your own culture, you know?
Exactly. I mean, if you have to do a comic book, do you need to draw a person that is getting inside into a car that is driving inside of the city? So all of a sudden you find yourself with a bunch of problems that you need to solve by yourself. Okay, I need to draw a man. I need to draw a man that looks like the same man in every single panel.
Oh,
I need
yeah.
to draw the car, yeah, in different perspectives. So then all of a sudden you start solving things and then you start practicing, you know, and it's like, okay, I'm going to draw a hand for the first time because he need to grab, you know, a wallet or whatever.
Right.
So you need to figure things out, and that's how you indirectly train, basically.
Yeah, that's
true. Which I guess is what happened with you when you were writing. Probably you were writing at home or whatever.
Not really. You know, I drew a lot, and I had stories in my head that went with the drawings, but I didn't just write. And, you know, the only reason I just liked the public celebration and the rare acknowledgement from grownups that I was doing something that wasn't illegal. I just was like, I'll keep doing this. But I never, I don't even enjoy writing. I enjoy having written. I don't enjoy writing. I enjoy talking to people. So that I was a reporter before I was a writer in some ways, because I always talked to people that were older than me and that I didn't know. That sounds strange, but no, I mean, I could talk to people.
There you go. But that was your training, I suppose, right? Like, just because you were like talking to people, you were like a communicator somehow. And then all of a sudden, when you wrote the first article, you had so many hours on training that it happened, you know? There's people that they need to train, you know. There's people that training is good for them, who knows,
you know. It's I think for me it was the I was raised in the senior citizens community, so I was the only kid, and I wasn't allowed, and they had rules like I couldn't play outside. I was like it was like a funny kind of thing, and the ambulances would come like every other week, you know. It was really kind of strange. And talking to all the older people in the neighborhood, you know, they were all in their 70s and 80s. They were all survivors of the war. They were all the Great Depression.
Wow.
They, you know, all had tattoos and stuff from the war. And they were all from Philadelphia, New York, Boston. And I was down in, you know, Miami area. And none of them were from there. And so as a kid, I had like I realized that if you were polite and you listened, and you would get cookies and stuff, you know, like if you just listened to their stories and stuff. So I just became a journalist for food as a child, I think.
Incredible.
But the other kids thought I was really weird, because like I had opinions about like Bing Crosby and Mussolini and, you know, strange things from the 40s.
That early. Wow.
You know, just because all my context was like, like Bogart, not, you know, Schwarzenegger. It was just
nice, of course.
Just because of the intake of the stuff. What was the things that you were passionate about as a kid? What made you, when you drew, did you draw stuff that you saw that was already well known, or did you create yours from whole cloth?
Yeah, I'm almost similar. I mean, like for example, my first comic book that fell into my hands, I didn't know even how to read. And it was a volume of from Tintin. And my father was reading to me. He was basically okay, this is what is happening. And I remember vividly some of the panels of that particular volume. And I became very obsessed about Tintin, you know, and I was like, I wanna be a comic book artist. Very, very from the early. I want to create my own worlds. And I create my own character. It was called Beto, which he was a guy with a super funny hair. And, you know, he was constantly, you know, full of action, falling from cliffs, but then saving his life. And I was always like filling up pages with no kind of like direction, basically just like telling a story with no end. And then sometimes I was stuck and I'm like, where this goes? But piles and piles of paper, very weird. I don't even understand how it grew on me.
That's interesting because, you know, a lot of people get drawn to art. And I know for me, I would draw an image, but is interested in the movement as you were in the image.
Totally. For at least the first 10 years, everything was like comic books. I was not so much about creating a piece of art. It was more about comic books. And then I gave it to my sister as she was 4 years older, and then to my parents, and then they read it. And then, you know, like later on, vampire comic books, crime, people getting killed, detectives trying to solve the thing, a detective called Lord Pepper. I don't know. I had like a bunch of fucking stuff. That even every time that I come here, I'm like a little bit like, you know, it's like, oh my God, what am I going to do with all this paper? You know, it's like, I don't have the courage of throwing it away or burning it or whatever it is, but it's worth, suppose, nothing. And I don't know what to do with it, you know?
Invaluable is another word for something that's worth nothing. You know, like, you know, just because it's not worth anything doesn't mean it's worthless.
It's true. I mean, it has a sentimental value for sure. And it's almost, I feel a little bit of
superstitious, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like
sentimental. It's sentimental.
It's a little bit of like, it's almost like betraying the younger yourself, if all of a sudden you take all that work and then put it in the bin, you know, it's a little bit sad for that kid.
Yeah, because it meant so much to you then. If it meant so much to you then, why should it mean so little to you now? But
exactly.
It's an interesting thing. It's an interesting, you know, question. Is art the object or was it the experience? You know, like for me, when I paint, I never know when to stop. Like, well, I do know when to stop, but I don't. Because I'm enjoying, to me, art is almost, because I'm not good enough to have it realize, I can't realize it the way I see it in my mind, so it frustrates me, so I don't enjoy it as an object, so I continue the experience until it's past being an object of value. I paint until it's not a painting anymore.
Wow.
It's almost subconscious. I didn't realize that that's what I was doing for a long time. And it's funny because I interviewed Ridley Scott a few times and you know, he's a big painter, you know, and he trained as a painter. He was in the same class. I've always tried to get him to do an interview together with David Hockney. They were in a class together. They studied, they were in an advanced painting course. I'm not sure the exact citation of the class and stuff like that, but it was a very serious part of their scholarship, and before Ridley started making TV commercials, and I was fascinated by that, and I was like, wow, the idea of you guys in the class together is just tremendous.
Imagine.
And he showed me some of his paintings, and he, you know, Gladiator started as he saw a painting and was, I want to make a movie about that painting and turn that painting into a movie, which was kind of interesting, but of his own art. His own art, he said that he can't leave a canvas alone. He keeps going back to it, and then he gets lost in the details, and then he gets frustrated because it, and I can totally relate, because you can't stop, you know, and it occurred to me later is that that's what he did that's Prometheus, is he's going back to the canvas. That's the Blade Runner, the 2049. He's going back to the canvas.
Oh.
You know, I feel like calling him, like, don't do it. He said,
stop
you
it.
He also said one of the most interesting things that I ever heard. I was asking about writing, because, you know, he's written so much these years, but he doesn't write anymore. And I said, why? He's like, I'm not brave enough to go in that room alone.
Wow.
And I was like, wow. And he like really meant it. And I don't quite get it. So fascinating.
Writing is a hell of a thing. And I totally get it. I am in the middle myself for like writing next projects, and it gives you so much insecurity, especially because you are creating something that you might like, and then the next day you hate it, and then who knows if people is gonna like it? You know, at least, you know, art in, and when you kind of like do sort of like figurative art, there is a point in which you are, you know when it's good. You understand if technically at least it's good. Now that the image is something that everybody likes, well, you don't know. But I think that writing is so much about, of course, technically you can say, yeah, this is well written, but do people is gonna really like it? Do people is gonna really understand it? Do people is gonna criticize it and is gonna say like, dude, this is horrible. This is falling apart. Doesn't make any sense, you know? And it's definitely, you know, but I always think about the first writers when they wrote the first book. And I also think about how long it takes to write a good novel or a good script. I mean, Paul Schrader apparently wrote Taxi Driver in like weeks, like crazy, with Shane his Black brother.
Lethal Weapon in 3 weeks in a car on a typewriter. He went and got the typewriter to do that and then typed
it. I hate that. You know, like, fuck off. Are you kidding? It's true. I totally hate it. But when you read, most of the times, people take 10 years writing like a good novel. Like this was written That's between right. 1965, 1975. And it makes sense. But when you want to do a product like, you know, film, and you want to start doing it, you almost want to solve things in a month. Like, okay, let's just start writing. But it needs to take much more than that.
Yeah, but you need to not know. See, like, I need to not know how hard it is.
Yeah.
The reason my first book, I think, well, there's a bunch of reasons it got done is because people are yelling at me to finish it. But one of the reasons I did it, I guess I should say, is that I was naive and to not know how hard it was or to all the things that could go wrong. And there's a lot to that. You get a lot of criticism from youth of just not knowing what you're doing is outlandish. Like you don't even know you're being audacious necessarily.
Yeah.
Because you're moving too fast and you don't have context. And, you know, there's the saying, it's easy to be a genius at 25. It's almost impossible to be a genius at 50.
Really? You think so?
I thought a lot about it because it was the filmmaker that made Nosferatu said that. I thought at times it was about the way that people perceive you, like, oh, everybody roots for you, or, you know, or then I thought, oh no, maybe it's about the shifting times, like technology, like the things I was so adept at that made me frustrated with my parents. Now I see my kids and I'm like, oh my God, it's changing even faster. Like, you know, maybe it meant that. And then I thought, no, maybe it meant doing something, a second act, you know, like beating yourself, you know, the competition with yourself. And after much thought, I decided I don't know what it means.
Well, it's probably what it means, but I mean, it makes sense. Maybe with usually you imagine that with certain amount of maturity, you are able to create specific things just because, you know, obviously I am way more mature than when I was 20. And when I think about myself when I was 20, it will be very difficult that I deliver anything that's what I am delivering now. It is kind of like incredible when I see the career of some people, you know, like for example, David Fincher. I think that he when he did the Fight Club, I don't think if he was even 30, probably he was in his 20s or something like that, right?
Orson Welles. I mean, Orson Welles did Citizen Kane when he was 24.
I know. And the amount of work that they have as well, the titles, you know, like.
Yeah. But then think of the suffocating pressure after that, that he never did another thing that on that. I mean, he did great things, Out of the Past. What was it? Touched by Evil. I'm sorry. He did Touched by Evil. He did all kinds of good stuff, but he didn't do Citizen Kane again, you know.
Citizen Kane, no. And his life went like, whoa, down some weird corridor. It's crazy. Yeah. But how can you do Citizen Kane when you're on your 20s? I don't understand. How can you have that sense of maturity, not only on the story, but, you know, like filmmaking, directing a huge crowd, you know, like you are 20 something, you are basically a kid. I mean, and he totally looks like an adult. I mean, even in Citizen Kane, he looks on his 50s, I would say. Like, he's like a total gentleman.
Well, in the early scenes.
Orson Welles is from where I'm from, kind of. He's from like Kenosha. He's from like Kenosha. And he was like plucked out of there as a teenager. Like, he started touring in theater. And he was kind of, that's how he got like a 10-year head start. He was a protege. I forget the actress's name, but she was a touring actress who was doing Shakespeare all over the country. Well, it makes total sense.
Definitely has a career before.
So he got to start acting and start directing when he was still a teenager. So
are you talking about Orson?
Orson
Welles.
And radio with the Mercury.
It's true, in radio with the whole invasion of the aliens. That was massive.
War of the Worlds broadcast, which was great. People thought it was real. You know, the complexity of Citizen Kane, you know, certainly like beggars like imagine, you know, description, but it's when I heard, it's also when people have these like moments of insight, like, you know, James Taylor, I saw this video of him singing Fire and Rain back in the early 70s. And I didn't realize, I guess he was 22 when he wrote that song. And to have that kind of emotional, like, to me, that's almost more impressive than Citizen Kane. Because like with Citizen Kane, you can have a crew, and, you know, maybe if you get the right people around you and they'll help you, and you have months and you can edit and stuff. But how do you have that kind of emotional, like Fire and Rain? How do you find that? As a man child, you know, and I think that's kind of interesting. And all the people that have their great albums, you know, and stuff when they're 27, like 27 is the, you know, and I know when I was 27, like for me, like I had, that was the year my book came out. That was the year I got hired at the LA Times. It was the year that a whole bunch of things happened to me. And I don't know if it's just a coincidence or sort of the search for synchronicity that we all like, or if there's actually something to that, you know.
I like that. Well, it's a beautiful age, 27. Fuck, I wish, you know. I wish I can go back to that moment.
Yeah, that would be good. It was also the first, that was the year I went to Europe for the first time, the year that my first child was born. So it was
a lot of things. Wow. Incredible. Yeah,
I remember at the time thinking, this is special, like knowing, like I actually was very, very conscious of it, because of course I, by that point, was a senior citizen because I've been raised the way I was. So
yeah.
I want to talk to you about Windshield Wiper because it's awesome. It looks beautiful, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Tell me a little bit about that look and the aesthetic. I was really struck by it. I like the choices you made, but I can't say that I could tell you what they all are, like as far as how it was accomplished, if that makes
sense. Nice. Yes. Well, that's cool. I like to sort of like create things generally that they are not very kind of like easy to analyze. Okay, this was done like this. Okay, I understand technically how it's done. I like to create some sort of like a mystery, and I don't do it just for the sake of just confusing the audience, like, oh my God, how this thing has been done. But I realized that the final result usually is because I am very traditional filmmaker in a way, like I like traditional film. I like traditional animation and I like traditional film as well. But I like to mix it with the new technologies that I can find out there, either 3D or any sort of like a software for cloud simulation, liquid simulation, anything that kind of like, you know, make whatever tradition, sort of like a traditional idea that I have in me, like to make it like far beyond. So the way that I do things is basically how Bambi was done, you know, how was done things back in the time, just like a background with a painting, you know, with a character in the middle. But that character happened to be 3D and that character happened to have a specific technology. And I usually also something that is very important, I like to base all my art in sort of like the basic rule of impressionism, which is what you can see with a hint of an eye. So the images, they need to be clear, you know, like I think that a good frame is a frame that you can actually recognize what are you seeing within a second. Otherwise it's messy and it's difficult to read, which is what happened a lot with these super blockbuster movies with all this amount of like, you know, special effects and 20 superheroes with, you know, with like a dragon and things that they're like, oh my God, where can I look? What is this? I see money everywhere, but I don't understand the image.
That's almost like making a poster instead of storytelling, like at that point. Oh, yeah. Everything, you know, and yeah. The aesthetic of what's happening, what matters, and what's next.
Yes, absolutely. That's very well said. Yes, I think that each frame nowadays is more like a poster. It's true. It's like all the information that you can put, make sure that the bad guys are here, make sure that the effect is here, make sure the money is here. So yeah, that's what I like to do when I do film, basically everything based in impressionism. And by saying that as well, I would say that I like to get rid of details that you don't really need, you know, because otherwise I think that the problem that we have with very realistic 3D is the uncanny valley, right? It's something that usually do not that you know accept. But if you look at ourselves right now, we are, you know, we have certain age, we probably have wrinkles and everything, but I cannot tell it, you know, I cannot see it in the image and you can read the image. But in 3D, they tend to put, you know, every single detail, the wrinkles, the pores, every single hair. And then I think that the eye becomes saturated, you know, and that's basically what creates the uncanny valley, the super saturation. I think that impressionism, like when we are looking at things, we only see on focus whatever we are focusing. Anything around is very much diffuse. So in a movie, you don't do that. In a movie, unless you, in 3D, you build the entire world, you add tons of details, even the things that they are super far away and maybe you don't need them. So I tend to solve a lot of things with painting and with simplification and synthesis is my favorite thing to do, always based on the physics of light, which is all very important.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting as you're saying all that, it occurred to me, and I'm not sure it really ever occurred to me before, but how much it is like music, you know, John Williams, I think he did the most famous piece of music in history because I don't know anything else you can identify. How many notes is that? You know, Jaws is like, is that two notes, right?
Oh, really?
You know, like, you know, especially if you're in a swimming pool, you recognize it immediately, but it's...
Yeah, you leave. You just run away.
It's not about a bunch of notes. And then I think about, you know, John Williams, when I went to see War Horse and everything, it was so like grab you by the lapels and like hit you. The music was so much. And yeah. I was like, God, what happened to like knowing what to leave out? You know, like more is less after a point because it just becomes numbing. There's no level. There's no choices. There's no style. So and that's what you're talking about with the animation screen. You know, some people are just jamming it with as many notes as they can. So it's like Amadeus.
Yeah, absolutely. It becomes stodgy. Almost. It's like, oh my God, what is this? I cannot swallow it too much.
Yeah,
if you get rid of details, but you leave the enough information, the brain does the rest. And that's what you want. You don't want to have that experience of like being overwhelmed by it and not letting the brain to complete things. You know, it's the same as storytelling. I think now that we are talking about similar samples, like I feel that movies nowadays, they are very much about explaining shit. It's like constant explanation, nonstop. They are explaining cell phones, even in the run. Yeah.
As soon as people got cell phones in movies, we were all dead. We're done. Because now that you can just explain stuff all through the whole movie, like without, and still walk around. Like we couldn't do that before. Like now it's like, oh, like I swear, like 24, it's just a phone call. It's just people talking on phones and walking briskly.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I don't know why. I think that the directors nowadays or the producers or whatever, they feel that they owe something to the audience because they are paying $20 to get into the film. And it's like, let's make sure that this motherfucker understand everything. Otherwise, you know, he's paying. But how beautiful is when they leave things that they are not explained, you know, when you leave things up to the audience to figure things out. I think that That's mature filmmaking. It's like not knowing everything. Sometimes even as a filmmaker, you might not know. Right. Why not?
Oh, you know, that's really cool. Like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, like, for example, Memento is a movie that, you know, is a lot of people like that movie, but I was thinking that it's so complex. That film is so complex and it has so many layers that the entire movie is a lot of explanation. But I think that the best part of the movie for me is the end. When they leave the whole thing rotating, and as an audience, you are like, oh my God, what is gonna happen? Wait a minute, are they gonna leave me like this? Wait a minute. You know, and they leave, they finish the movie. I think that was worth watching because finally at the end, they didn't explain.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did you see that movie, The Orphanage? It was a horror film.
The Orphanage. Yeah, that was Spanish.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I talked to the director the director believed in ghosts, but the screenwriter didn't.
Interesting.
So the screenwriter, and so nothing supernatural happens in the movie necessarily. Like you can say it did or didn't, but like, I thought it was really interesting because so the story believes in ghosts, but the vision of the story doesn't. And I'm like, that's actually a really interesting energy. They should like try to put people together like that more often.
Wow.
There's something to it that it kind of, if they're both happy at the end, then you probably have a perfect movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Interesting. Yeah, maybe putting together like an atheist and a... and a full-on Christian or something like that.
Exactly.
That happened all the time. I mean, was these guys? There is this team of people. Forgot the names, but they did A Room with a View.
Merchant Ivory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Remains of the Day. Sure. The Ivory. There is like him. The writer, I think, is Indian woman, like ethnicity Indian woman, or maybe the producer is, but the three of them, they have like completely different ethnicities and I suppose that also completely different religions and beliefs. And then they do all these such a beautiful products that are like, wow, these movies are amazing. It always kind of like surprised me every time that I see sort of like making of those particular movies from Ivory. I'm like, oh my God, look at these three. This team, it looks like so, you know, like, how can I say? Yeah, they look so different from each other. And I'm pretty sure that they have political and maybe even religious beliefs that they are like different. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, I don't know about the religious one, but I mean, those movies don't have much religion in them. But anyway, so like, I don't even know how it would come across, but the I love those movies. I love Remains of the Day, especially.
Remains of the Day is incredible.
It's a tremendous film. And Christopher Reeve in that, you know, like I'm a big Christopher Reeve fan. And so I look at that with a lot of wistfulness because that was like, I was so glad he had that role. That was shortly before his accident, if I remember right. I'm so glad he had that role because it was not Superman and it was a success and it was critically acclaimed. And he was a full adult male presence in it. And, you know, it just, if that hadn't been on his resume, if the accident had been before that, I think there would have been an extra layer of sadness on top of all the sadness, you know, just because he hadn't had that in a while, you know, at that time.
Yeah, I mean, because he was such a fucking good Superman, man. I mean, face.
He was the best. And he also was just like, the earnestness, like, you know, I mean what I'm saying. And I'm still standing here in this costume and I know it and it's okay. Like, I mean, that's hard to pull off, that, you know. And the director, Richard Donner, the great Richard Donner, who just died, made me very sad. I got to interview him a bunch of times, a couple times on stage and in his office, and got to know him pretty well. And one of my favorite things is his stories about Christopher Reeve are just fantastic. You know,
really?
Greatest stories about Christopher Reeve. One of the best ones being the day that they were shooting somewhere in England, and Chris was supposed to be there and he's late. Where is he? And Dick Donner's this big guy with this big voice. And he's like, you know, and everybody jumps, and it's, he tells the story really well. And then there's this prop duster flying by, you know, a prop plane, and it circles and lands on the meadow that they're in, and out gets Christopher Reeve. Out gets a beautiful woman, out comes a picnic basket. And he's like, sorry, guys, I'm late. I just met somebody and we just got carried away. Okay, I'll see you later. And like, it wasn't amazing. His plane, it wasn't his girl, it wasn't his picnic basket. And he was late. And, you know, I'm like, that guy is Superman. That's awesome. That's like one of the greatest things I've ever heard. What a great entrance. It's just the idea of him getting off of that airplane. If you didn't think he was Superman before that, you would afterwards certainly think he could pull it off. But he just seemed like a pretty cool guy. Dick Donner, when he got the job to do Superman, when he got the go-ahead, I said, so what'd you do? And he goes, well, I rolled a big fat joint. I put on a red cape. I smoked the joint. And I went out and I flew around my driveway and yelled, wee! I'm like, really? Wow. Okay.
Wow.
Great answer. Like, I would ask sooner if I knew that was going to be the answer.
Totally.
So, well, tell me a little bit about the windshield wiper look.
Yes.
And it's, you know, I love the images are just fantastic. You know, it's like seeing a Godard film, like flip through images. It was pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, it is a non-linear film, and it's very much what I wanted to do is a film more about feelings, more than to tell a specific story. And, you know, it's talking about love, it kind of like makes sense that everything are sort of like vignettes. You remember before we were saying that almost like most of the films, they are like trying to explain. I was kind of like doing the opposite. I actually want to do something where you need to feel something. The images, they need to make you feel in a certain way. You know, it's just like everybody's been somehow either breaking up or having some bad argument or whatever in the beach with somebody, right? Yeah. And I remember vividly one of the times that I broke up with my first ex-girlfriend. You are like that, you know, like both of you are facing to the horizon. There is no exchange. There is no cross on your eyes. And basically you are both facing into the same direction, but there is no cross, you know, there is not this kind of like, this body language that actually shows any affection. You are both kind of like ready to depart. And that's what I wanted to transmit. You know, like I want people to watch the film and understand through images something that might happen in anybody else's life. And that's the most important thing for me. You know, it's like feelings, like you need to feel rather than understand. I think that that's more interesting for me when you make a film, like to give some sort of like a feeling rather than, okay, I got the film. Yeah, I understood. This is cool. Right. $20 that they are worth.
Yeah, yeah. It's not an empirical argument. It's a tone poem. It's like a,
yeah,
you know, that's interesting. It definitely felt like seeing snatches of moments of where either love was found or lost. Was kind of what I took away from the images, the montage of it, and it made me think of Rear Window in a strange way, like you know, looking into all these lives and
seeing, yeah,
these moments that even without context you could feel the weight of the exchange or the end of either something starting or ending, you know.
Yes, totally. And you know, films are sometimes very, I mean, there is, you get the camera into somebody else's life and then you leave it later on. It's just like, usually it's voyeuristic. I mean, film is voyeuristic. You're basically with no discretion at all. You're just watching somebody else's life for 2 hours. Yeah. Sometimes it's the entire life. Sometimes it's just like one day or a few weeks.
Yeah.
And you're just watching, you know, eating popcorn. So it's purely voyeuristic. And I think that that's the magic of cinema, mostly. Like let's be super noisy and watch these people.
Yeah. It is interesting because at one point cinema was to create something very lifelike, but then it became to create something that's not lifelike. It's like bigger and better than life and different than life. And it's interesting that tug between those imperatives, you know. And also between the, you know, I think, you know, if you look at film criticism, you know, I've always been suspicious of criticism. Like, I had a chance to try to be a critic a few times and was encouraged to and always resisted it because I'm a little skeptical of the whole thing. Because I think to be read and to be popular as a writer, if you're a critic, the only way to do that is to be vivid and emphatic. And a lot of times,
and aggressive, perhaps, right?
Yeah, and I, a lot of times I don't feel strongly about something, and I think that if you don't feel strongly about something and you write about it, it's going to not be good writing. And if you pretend to feel strongly about it, then it's not good criticism. But you know, there we are. So like, I always thought it was a little intellectually dishonest, and also I change my mind too much. You know, I just really do. And also I'm subject to the same things as other people. Like I say, I like Radiohead 13% more than I really do because I want people to think I'm interesting, you know?
Interesting.
Kind of, you know what I mean? Like, the thing with film is that all the film critics come from a writing background. I mean, that's obvious. I mean, even the ones on television, like Ebert and Siskel, when they were on TV, they were both writing, they were newspaper, you know, writers. But it comes from like a literary tradition. And not saying newspapers or journalism or criticism is literature, but it's coming from the words and writing. And I think that when they write about film that is more, or music that's more about the feeling than about the thought, that they aren't as kind, you know. And I think it's like music critics never wrote about James Brown the way that they would write about Bob Dylan, you know, because it's harder to express what James Brown's doing, but because it's less cerebral, you know, potentially in the way it's executed.
Totally.
It's not, it's much more elusive, you know, it's much more in the heart and the feeling and in the balls and in the feet and the, you know, in the back and everywhere. I don't even know what point I'm trying to make at this point. I'm sorry. I was just saying like,
Yeah, we were talking about the film now. I mean, the
point of a film is it to communicate something, or is it a feeling or a thought? That's what I was getting at.
Exactly.
Feeling doesn't get as much credit as thought because the people that give credit are thinking.
I think it should be both. I mean, it's. I think that obviously the best films for me are the ones that they keep me, that they leave me thinking, and the ones that they allow me to have my own interpretation of it. Like, for example, one of my favorite films is The Double Life of Veronica from Kieślowski, and he doesn't explain much, and it's just a woman that she sees herself, like a woman that exactly looked like herself in the city for the first time, going on top of a bus. And the whole movie is just so beautiful. And he just leaves so many of your questions unanswered that I found it that is very interesting. You know, and he's like, okay, I need to watch it again. I'm going to watch it again. I'm going to go and read, you know, like David Lynch every time that he... Yeah. That like you see Mulholland Drive, and he's like, wait a minute, what did I just watch? I need to go and read in internet. And it's, and then you see that there is,
yeah, 2001 A Space
Odyssey, 2001
Apocalypse Now, you know,
Apocalypse Now is true. There is a lot of films, yeah, exactly. They leave you thinking, and then you need to do your own research. It's like, what did I watch, and why do I feel uneasy, or why do I feel. I think that that's the point of making a cool movie. I mean, for me, obviously there is a lot of people that they want another type of entertainment, and that's cool, but that's not for me.
Yeah, like The Shining, for instance. Like I could, you know, you could put a gun to my.
No.
I've seen it many, many times, and always affected by it, and always fascinated by it. I know I've seen it to the credits, but I couldn't tell you what happens. Like, you know, it's like a fever dream, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Retrieve it. For Windshield Wiper, do you remember the was there a single inspiration or for the title and for the premise? Or?
Oh, the Windshield Wiper, the title or the film itself?
Yes, either, both.
Okay, both. The film, I basically wanted to kind of like talk about what love means sort of like nowadays socially. You know, it's a question that has been with us for a long time and it's very difficult to answer, but sort of like it's almost like easier to answer what love was back in the time, I think. You know, like why we needed love, why we needed relationships. And I think that, of course, back in the time, the concept of family was super, super convenient because, you know, like you have a strong family. That means that you're going to have like a good heritage. That means that they're going to have, you're going to have help in your business or in the land or in whatever, right? So you try to find something that is strong. So your clan is strong for the next following years. And then also your kids are going to need to have a strong family. Nowadays feels that the concept of family, it is not as important as it was back in the times. And people usually have now one or two kids. It's very rare to see these families that they are like 8 kids, for example, right? It's not anymore. So I feel that the concept of, you know, relationships and love, it really changed lately because everybody's very worried about, you know, many things like your career, your evolution as an individual. I don't know, like your fun, your self-growth, your own persona. I feel that people is not that interested nowadays on, okay, I need to find the perfect person so I can create a strong family. There is people that are happy to be single all their life. So the concept of commitment drastically change over the last few, I would say 30, 40 years. It drastically changed. So relationships are very, very strange nowadays, and they are in some sort of like a strange limbo. So when you have to describe what is love socially, I find myself that I'm like, oh my God, I'm not that sure. I have the examples of my family, my mother, my father, my grandparents, you know, like married until the end. And then I have the example of what I see in the street, you know, like the people that they are like quite unreliable, the people that they don't answer, or the people that they don't want any serious commitment. Myself, my career is over everything, you know, like that's more or less what I wanted to depict, the concept of what is love nowadays, and how I see it, you know. So it's very, very personal in a way.
Yeah. And you're right. It's over the last few generations, it's the change has been just extraordinarily jagged. It's a jagged change. And add on top of that, the gender issues, gender inequality, gender equality, yeah. gender politics, the change in role of gender and income and how that changes things. And it is fascinating. I hadn't thought about it I hadn't thought about it in the effect on sort of the family unit that coming from that direction, but in a way, it makes all of us less part of a continuum. You know, people identify themselves more by what their family did as a unit, and you know, certainly in the times, you know, times when you know it was sort of agrarian society, because it's just the numbers. People, family needed numbers, and they did things as a group. You know, they were cohesive. I think there's less generational cohesion now than before. So I think there's like a less sense of family identity. You know, there's more individual identity perhaps, but less allegiance, less confederacy, so to speak.
100%. I mean, I think that people is more worried about making an impact themselves in this world rather than,
The Gallup poll, you know, they poll people and get their opinions on things, and they've done it for, you know, decades and decades. There was a change in it after like four decades. They asked people, what do you want in life, and rank these things. And for the first time, the thing that they switched, like what was the top priority, like switched, like I think it was like less than a decade ago, but the first time Americans said that they would rather be famous than rich.
Of course.
but you know, having everybody know who you are, I don't know if on scrutiny if it makes sense. Like,
I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense.
I can see
in
why
a society in a society like now.
We are.
It didn't make sense before, but now we are constantly exposed. You know, how many people is all of a sudden, you know, the mother of your friend is doing a TikTok. It's like, what need do you have to start doing some dancing in the kitchen when you are chopping onions? It's almost like absurd, but everybody want it.
Yeah.
It's almost like a drag. Like, people want to be famous. They want to be, you know, they want to be loud. They want to make an impression. Yeah, they want to be acknowledged. And it's in a society like today because recognition is very awarded. You know, people that they have recognition, they have like a tons amount of people that they follow them, tons amount of money. All of a sudden, things become somehow easier. I guess that is the dream, right? Like having...
It's affirmation.
Yeah.
It's affirmation.
Yeah. And before you were happy with, you know, finding your partner for life and creating a family, create a house. And if you succeed in your business, amazing. If you can leave something to your kids, amazing. That was basically 40 years ago. That's how, or at least in Spain, 40 or 50 years ago, that was the basic need. Very few people, they were okay, or few families, they were like extremely rich and they were doing amazingly well. But most of us, we were sort of like happy with whatever, right? So I am in the middle. I feel myself, I'm in the middle. Like, I have the example of my parents and the previous generations, and same as you were talking with the old people, right? So all of a sudden you are dealing with people your generation, or, you know, slightly younger, especially if you all of a sudden start dating somebody that is like, you know, I'm 42 now. If all of a sudden I start dating somebody that is like 28 or 29, that's a massive gap. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just like the needs and the and the codes, the social codes, everything is like completely different, you know. So I am very much in the middle, and I think that the windshield wiper was sort of like an excuse for me to kind of like tell this sort of like situation that we are in without telling too much, basically suggesting and trying to give you some sort of like a feeling of it.
Yeah, the contours of that. That makes sense. So it's interesting. I think you're definitely onto something. A lot of times when we create art and it goes out and finds audience, then it becomes something different, comes back to us, and over time it changes again. You know, I've always thought it's kind of like a triangle. There's the artist and the audience, and then the actual object, or you know what the creation is, and the relationship between all three changes over time. You know, like my relationship to Woody Allen movies has changed. Woody didn't change, and the movies didn't change, but I changed. So the movies haven't changed, but the way that we view them has changed, or the context of dark times and things. But it's just interesting to think about that. For you, with windshield wiper, even though it's a relatively short period of time, has it come back to you in any way that's unexpected, or do you see any part of it differently now?
Yes, that's a very good question. There's just something that is kind of like very interesting about when I do things, which is like, I understand things better with distance, in fact. And there is a lot of things that happened during the process that I was doing them mechanically. I was believing on them. I was inspired by them. And then later on, I realized, oh, fuck, that's what I was doing. Mm. Sometimes I realize in the process, and it's very good, because when I realize in the process, and then I kind of like force my direction towards that direction.
Yeah, calibrate to acknowledge.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, for example, just to put an example, I did this film, The Witness, that it was part of the anthology, The Love, Death, and Robots. And it's kind of like a loop. It's kind of like a chase. And I wrote the script very kind of like super fast. And I saw it very clearly. And it's like, okay, this is what I want to do. And then I realized later that what I was basically depicting is some sort of like a toxic relationship. One of those relationships that you cannot actually leave. That you keep coming and you keep coming, or probably based on sex or in some sort of like, or another emotional sort of like level, but you keep coming and it's painful and both parts are victims. And while I was doing it, I realized about it, but no one I wrote it. When I was doing it, I realized what it was about. And then I start adding elements that they were very significant for me, and then everything started making way more sense. And it was very crazy when I realized, like, wow, it's crazy that I was thinking about this, because even I was including symbols that they are like, you know, historically well-known symbols that they depict specific things, you know, and I was even doing them subconsciously. And with the windshield wiper happened something similar. There are some scenes that I understood later. And there are some, you know, some unresolved issues of mine that I'm kind of like seeing them there. And I'm like, oh, wow. So it makes sense why I was doing this film. Because I started a long time ago. I started 7 years ago. But I stopped it because I was working on other films, and then I came back, and then I stopped, came back. But I realized later on what was the real reason. And it was this that I told you, right? That I was very much kind of like in the middle between these generations, and when the love is kind of like really, or society is really changing. So love now is even more difficult to define. So I realized later, I don't know, in 10 years from now, and keep to your question, how I'm gonna see the windshield wiper, you know, probably, I don't know, probably I'm gonna think that is I don't know. Maybe I don't gonna like it. Same as I'm checking my drawings now, and I'm, you know, these ones that I have in this room, and I'm like, oh my God, this is maybe who knows? We evolve technically and emotionally and spiritually as well. So maybe we are not agree with ourselves later on.
Yeah, I find when I look back on stuff, I can appreciate the moments of growth. Like I can see when I had leaps, and I can appreciate those. And I just kind of try not to look too much into things that I would do, like, oh, you know, like if it's a craft thing or if I was limited in some other way, I try not to pay attention to the limited stuff. I try to pay attention to the stuff that is the breakthrough, you know. I could talk to you all day.
Thank you.
one last thing I'll ask. I like a Mount Rushmore gimmick. You know, who would be the four people that you would put on your Mount Rushmore for either animation or for art, for you personally? Like who would be your four North Stars, if you could have
my four tops? Okay, first one, 100% I would say Hergé, who is the author of Tintin, just because sure. I got my career there and because I'm fascinated by that universe. Secondly, I would say, in terms of meaning, I'm kind of like almost going chronologically, which is strange. Like my for the same thing, you know, it's like how all of a sudden feature films in animation, they become a thing. It was like wow, you know. And despite the product that they might do nowadays is not totally up to my alley, I think that you know, history, in terms of history, you know, like the 101 Dalmatians or Snow White or Bambi, all those super dramas, they are like incredible. Very much love that.
And he's so audacious, you know, he took such big chances. He gambled everything three different times, three different things that had never been done before. He's like, I'm all in, I'm going to make Snow White. It's never been done before. I'm all in, I'm going to do Disneyland. You know, it's never been done before. You know, like it's he just kept doing it. You know,
yeah, total visionary.
Yeah.
But the art of animation is absurd. I mean, like I love it, but it's like you need to draw one fucking drawing per second. Yeah. It's like, impossible. Like, why you want to do that? we pursue and then we are doing it. It's absolutely madness to make a feature animation. Fourth, I would say then later, Kieflowski. Oh, sorry, my battery.
Okay.
I'm here. Kieflowski. Yeah, Kieflowski. I love it because, you know, he did this, the Decalogue, which is his TV show in the 1980s, that for me is like emotionally, in an emotionally level, one of my favorite things ever. The way of telling the stories, putting the cameras, etc., is like, wow, beyond everything. And then I don't know, man. Then I don't know. I think that, you know, there's like...
three.
It's very difficult to choose because there are so many, you know, like I could say Kubrick, I could say, you know, Hitchcock, just because the roots that they put, but I cannot choose one over the other, you know, I cannot do that. So, or Kieflowski already mentioned, Tarkovsky, just because, I couldn't choose one over another.
I respect that answer. That's good. I'd rather have three that you believe than four that you're tepid about.
Yeah, I'm tepid about, because there's like a lot of writers as well that I would like to mention now, but I'm like, would I choose this writer over Kubrick? Yeah. I don't know.
In college, we used to drink and we used to play a game where we would take two people like Abraham Lincoln and Charles Darwin, and you have to decide. You have to eliminate one from history. Who goes? you know, and we were trying to come up with the toughest ones for individual people that we knew. Like, you know, I would say to you, like, Walt Disney and Hitchcock, and you'd be like, you know, like which do you subtract? It's a brutal thing to think about. Like, you know, would you lose Dickens or Twain? You know, like,
whoever you lose, we wouldn't be even talking right now. Yeah. You know, if you take one single grain of sand of this world, I'm pretty sure, I totally believe on the butterfly effect. Like any single person, you just remove it, and the whole future changes 100%. It has to. It's just like it's physics and chemistry. Like, you just take something out of the space, and then okay, there is a space that you have to fill up. Everything is gonna be affected by it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That'd be interesting to try to achieve that visually. You know, like pulling somebody out, the Jenga of history.
Totally.
But well, what a treat to talk to you. And I wish you well there in your childhood home. I think you're at risk there. I think you might have some sort of psychic vulnerability. So I'm a little worried about you, but I really, really enjoyed talking to you. And I know Maya did as well. And I hope you'll join us again here sometime. We'd like to catch up with you after
anytime.
All the big awards and everything.
Anytime. It was amazing talking, like super refreshing. And you know, we are having a number of interviews and things now, and all the questions, they're like kind of like going into the same direction. And I'm like, oh my God. So it was very cool to have like a whole open philosophical and artistic talk. That was very cool.
Well, if you want to have a conversation without a point, I'm the guy.
Cool. Thank you so much.
I always tell people I'd rather have a conversation that's Miles Davis than Sousa. You know, ooh. I want jazz, not marching band. Like, marching parades are the most boring thing I've ever seen in my life. Like,
yeah, it's true.
Walking.
It is true.
Thanks for tuning into Mindspace. You just heard Jeff Boucher in conversation with Alberto Mielgo, director of The Windshield Wiper, which is an Oscar-nominated short animated that's on YouTube right now, and you can check it out. You had a great time talking to Alberto.
Oh yeah, that was really, really enjoyable, and I've really enjoyed our recent conversations with animators, like mm-hmm. you know, this little kind of tour we're taking into the world of animation, because it's such an exciting time. And Alberto is one of the exciting people in that field. And, you know, with the Emmys that he's won and the success of the films that he's had, I'm sure we're going to be hearing his name a lot in years to come.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's already made his mark on so much. And I think, you know, looking through his CV, I was a fan of his without even knowing it. So, exactly. You know, I can't imagine where it's going to go from here. So.
He's a very likable fellow too. I really enjoyed talking to him. He's got he just seems very thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really cool. You know, when we were talking to him, I mentioned that Spanish film, The Orphanage. I'm not sure if I said it in the right order, the exact what applied to it, but the filmmaker and the writer disagreed on ghosts. And so what it was is that the director did not believe in ghosts and the screenwriter did. So it's a story that believes in ghosts, but in a film that doesn't, which is kind of intriguing. Mm-hmm. I found the original article I wrote back when the film came out, and the movie again was called The Orphanage, and it was 2007, right after Christmas, the story ran. And the director is Juan Antonio Bayona, also from Barcelona. Also from Spain, and his screenwriter, Sergio Sanchez, he and disagreed on the matter of ghosts. So I think that's fantastic. You know, Guillermo del Toro produced that film, and I remember talking to him back then, and he was super excited by the fact that Bayona and Sanchez did not agree on ghosts. He thought that was really a strong point for the movie. So I'm not sure if I said that in the right order, though, when we were talking during the show. So if not, I just wanted to correct that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's super interesting whenever there's a project in which two great minds clash. I think that there's a lot of those like that. I know that Even when you're in school, did you ever have to do that exercise either with drawings or with short stories where you would write one paragraph or draw part of the picture and then another classmate would finish it?
Yeah. And I like that, doing that kind of stuff. I think it's kind of fun. It can be frustrating sometimes, but it's a good way to learn how to deal with people and how to deal with yourself, you know, kind of dealing with people. But
talk about projects like that. I know there's, you know, I mean, in whatever genre, I feel like there's been a lot of masterpieces that were essentially creative battles.
Yeah. Contentiousness kind of built into it. You know, the Beatles, as we talked about previous shows, you know, I've always been amazed by how great Lennon and McCartney were together. And then the classic example is the, you know, getting better all the time. So Paul comes into the studio with the line, "It's getting better all the time," the natural optimist. And John immediately but perfectly undercuts it with "can't get much worse," which is the contrarian view, but also it really, you know, took that song to a new level. And that kind of energy, I think, I love their solo work as well, but I think that it was never quite the same as when they were together, just because of that creative friction. And I'm sure there's a lot of examples of that.
Yeah. I'm not sure A Day in the Life was contentious, but it definitely has that same kind of punch counterpunch to it.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is greater than the sum of its parts. You know, it's two great songs that taste great together, kind of thing. You know, neither of them had a complete song until, you know, got sewed together, and of course the result is made history, you know.
Yeah.
But mentioned that another example.
It was 2001, I think. I can't remember the particulars, but I know that Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick were kind of in step in the early development stages, but frequently by the end, like, could not be in the same room together.
Yeah, that does sound familiar. And I think it had to do with Kubrick pushing to make it increasingly ambiguous and obscure, like, you know, not wanting to sort of explain what was going on. And I think, if I recall right, that Arthur C. Clarke's just natural storyteller instincts were such that he wanted to make sure that people could at least stay on the ship, like, you know, not get lost in space, so to speak. So.
Yeah, the books are like tremendously different than the movies. Like, if you read Kubrick's adaptation, or not Kubrick's, Clarke's adaptation as a novel, which was after the movie, it just adds a bunch of detail. Like, I remember distinctly reading that in the chamber where David Bowman, the astronaut, is kind of imprisoned, kept as a specimen, through life, in the movie it's not quite clear what's happening to him. In the book it's kind of clear that he's a like a guinea pig in some sort of alien habitat, and the only thing he can eat is like a substance that's described like bread pudding. So he just eats this bread pudding, which is so different than the movie, where it's like, you know, you leap through decades and centuries without any kind of earthly reference, versus in the book, he's just like nibbling away at his bread pudding.
That's funny.
Because of course, like you said, Clarke is the hard sci-fi writer, is going to be like, well, how did he live? How did he survive? You know, versus it, you know, being a metaphor or something, or defying explanation. It's all just like, well, no, if he's an old man, he has to live 30 years in this little alien room, and he's got to have nutrients, and it's got to be a substance that's engineered to provide him everything he needs. And it would probably be something like bread pudding.
Right. Something that would not congeal under the gravitational, standards of that place. Yeah, exactly. With sci-fi writers, a lot of times explaining how things work is a big part of the gee whiz factor of why it's entertaining to people. You know, the kind of extrapolating, but it's not lyric. This is it's not a tone poem. It's 2001, and a lot of places it just becomes a tone poem. in a way.
Yeah, it's so wonderful. I was able to see that in like a full screen at like a midnight showing. So like my brain was going all sorts of weird places.
Yeah.
When COVID ends, would recommend.
Yeah. Anybody in Southern California should go by. They show it every year in 70 millimeter at the Egyptian. Cool. And it's one of the few places on the planet you can see it still on 70 millimeter. So.
The Egyptian. That's cool because their initial design for the monolith was an obelisk or like a pyramid, some sort of what would you call it? Orientalist, prismatic,
yeah,
monumental. Because the monolith, it's like it doesn't really register as a monument. It kind of defies any sort of versus an obelisk, which is too readable, you know.
yeah it's the Egyptian's a great place. They've had a lot of history there. If you ever come out to LA, you should definitely go by something. It's one of my favorite places in Southern California. But
yeah,
they used to have, when it first opened, Sid Robin opened it, the same guy that did open the Chinese up the street, same street. But they used to have Egyptian guards, guys dressed like Egyptians, what they thought Egyptian guards would look like, on the roof, like, you know, calling out the movies and stuff like that. And they had a lot of big premieres there, Sound Music, Singing in the Rain premiered there, and Return of the Jedi, a lot of really big films. They think Charlie Chaplin's ghost is haunting the place.
Oh, no. Return of the Jedi, was that one? I know that it caused a lot of creative breaks in the Star Wars team. No, I mean, I was thinking of
Empire
Strikes Back. I know Return of the Jedi was the result.
Yeah. Gary Kurtz, the producer, left while Empire was ramping up. So that would have been the major defection from the first movie, really. But he left it because of because Han Solo wasn't killed off in Empire, because the action figure was the best-selling action figure.
Why?
Yeah.
That's why he was frozen in carbonite?
Yeah. Because the original script was to kill him off. Han Solo doesn't really serve a purpose after Empire. And Harrison Ford, that's one of the reasons that he didn't particularly enjoy the films back in the day, because, you know, he felt like, his character should have been killed off. I guess George just couldn't bring himself to do it. And so they had to wait, until, more recent history.
Oh,
so I think that's why definitely Harrison came back, is because he wanted to put Han Solo on the ground.
Oh, okay. So was the moment he's frozen, is that in the script where, like, you can see the faint outlines of a death that was originally planned?
The rhythm of it speaks to the place in the story where he was going to be killed, probably, I would think. Mm-hmm. But not necessarily the method, obviously, but just sequencing.
Because structurally, I think it provides a great kind of introduction to the third movie and a reason for, the characters, just a great incitement to action. But you're right, after that, his arc just kind of stagnates. There's nowhere, I guess, that it went. So
yeah,
I can see why Harrison Ford would be unentertained by it.
Yeah, exactly. So and also he wasn't supposed to get the girl. I don't think Princess Leia was part of his thing originally either. And I think they sort of pushed that together to kind of keep him in the movie a little bit. But I talked to Gary Kurtz about it once, and he was still. He said George went to the dark side.
How do you think Star Wars as a franchise would have fared had it went as grim? And
the second one's pretty grim anyway, but I think it would have slowed it down in any way. I think you know, like you say, like I think by the time we got to Return of the Jedi, that movie's going to be huge no matter what, because it was just the ending. And I don't think having, if Han wasn't in it, or if he was one of the sparkly ghosts in the corner at the luau or something, I don't think it would have hurt the movie at all, as you know, commercially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, they killed Han Solo anyway, so, and it hasn't really, you know, stirred. There was no protest or anything. I was a little sad.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't imagine either on the original trilogy or the prequel trilogy or the sequel trilogy having to be assistant between the different writers and the producers and the brains behind Star Wars, having to ferry notes and corrections and arguments between people.
Yeah. Well, and you know, some of the recent revelations about the inner workings at Disney, you know, showed that you know, that process, it hasn't really been streamlined or improved much, because there was a lot of, I guess, there's been some coverage lately about some of the concessions that J.J. Abrams had to make and things like that.
Oh, like, is that in between after he did the first one, or?
I think it was on the last one that he did. That there was some scenes where he had to kind of concede to the Lucasfilm or mm-hmm. Disney pressure. I'm not sure which one it was.
Hmm.
Real question though is, when is Lucasfilm going to bring Howard the Duck back? You know, I think that's a real question.
It needs to be a buddy flick with Salacious B. Crumb, obviously.
I think so. Although Donald is probably a better bet. Just because of Donald Duck and just mm-hmm. because of Disney. I think Disney's, you know, they should really team up their Marvel characters with some of their traditional Disney characters. You know, like Little Mermaid and Namor, or, well, I thought Indiana Jones and Captain America would be a good mix.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know where Indiana Jones is going. I've heard things and other things. And
that looks confusing. Although, the one thing is they picked the right director. You know, if there's anybody that can get a good movie out of that franchise, I think it's him. So I think for that alone, if it wasn't for his presence, I would not be optimistic, but I think so highly of him that I'm gonna, you know, have optimism.
Yeah. Do you think of any other great artistic feuds?
Almost every band that's big for a long time eventually, you know, has a, you know, I think like the Eagles, you know, just despised each other at one point and still cranking out hits. And Pink Floyd, you know, the band was fractured and split. I think there's probably a lot.
Yeah. One of my favorite ones, I think it's the most clear cut, is The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, though we don't condone Ezra Pound on this show, obviously.
Yeah.
Where T.S. Eliot was just adding more and more and more, and Ezra Pound would cut whole chapters.
It is sort of fascinating. And then those people that do get into those kind of connected feud, creative feuding, I guess.
Yeah.
That when they go on their own, like the Lennon McCartney thing, you know, people are always kind of balancing the productivity. You know, is it better to be miserable in contention or to be indulgent in solo creativity? You know, sometimes people, when they lose the abrasive opposite part of the equation, they lose their own, they lose some of the sensibilities that rein them back in, you know?
Yeah.
So. But. Well,
Contrast to that, we got along great with Alberto Mielgo.
Absolutely. And animation, I guess, you know, you really do have to get along, because that is a process that is not a medium for the impatient or the contentious. Mm-hmm. Because that's a souffle that takes quite a while to bake.
Yeah, with infinitely many more ingredients. So
yeah.
Hats off to him. Check out his work. And we hope to talk to him again sometime.
Absolutely. And I hope we make it into the acceptance speech when he wins the Oscar.
You going to say that for everyone?
Everyone. I just got to
Everyone.
So, well, thanks for joining us on Mindspace. And we'll
thank
see
you all. Time. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. They love us. They really love us. Bye.